Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded March 29th and April 2nd, 2023. And welcome to the spring of discontent. While leaders in the capitals of Europe and America promise to carry on the Ukraine proxy war no matter the price, the people are already in the streets protesting the real and rising costs of that belligerence. For Canadians, whose government is already full-throatedly behind the bellicose stance against Russia, prospects of an expanded war against China and Iran, battles by sanction in Venezuela, Nicaragua, and elsewhere, there is to Haiti. Last week, the Trudeau Liberals blithely announced another $100 million to be delivered to the tiny island nation's military and police effort to keep the rest of population under heel. This on top of millions already delivered. It's almost as if Ottawa believes the fatted tax goose's golden eggs will never flag. Eve Engler is an independent Montreal-based journalist and author. He's written 12 books on Canadian foreign policy, including Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority, co-authored with Anthony Fenton. His recent article, Canadian Government Prioritizes War Over Climate Crisis, is a troubling portrait of a country few here in our home and native land would recognize. Eve Engler in the first half. And just what is Canada's place in the world? Generations of us have been taught we are global agents of good, fair-minded, and justice-seeking. You know, wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, we'll be there. Wherever there's a cop beating up a guy, etc., etc. It'd be a great story if only it were true. Prasanna Shanmugathas completed an advanced degree at one of Canada's world-class universities, but found beyond Canada's two solitudes another bifurcation, one not in the curriculum, separating the real from an imagined nation. And so, he says, he set out on an epic 3-year journey of discovery from coast to coast to coast and across the trackless prairies. He documented his Canadian quest in the film series Truth to the Powerless, an investigation into Canada's foreign policy. Prasanna Shanmugathas and the hunt for Canada's elusive identity in the second half. But first, Eve Engler and Trudeau of the Tropics, taking Haiti. Welcome back to the show, Eve.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's always my pleasure. You know that. Well, Eve, before we tackle Justin's Haitian adventures, you reported recently in an article titled Pro-Israel and Ukraine Groups Use Identity Politics to Attack Free Speech about an effort to cancel a lecture you were scheduled to deliver at King's College in London, Ontario. Now, Eve, why would anyone want to silence you?
Good question. I don't know. It's shouldn't everyone want to hear what I have to say? No. Yeah. Basically, it was an event on Canada's historic ties to Palestinian dispossession, and the Ukrainian student group on campus put out a statement basically saying, or explicitly saying, that I was a Russian propagandist and my event should be canceled because it would potentially lead to violence against Ukrainian students on campus. It was pretty out there. But unfortunately, the political climate on the NATO proxy wars in Canada is pretty out there as well. So it was very much an example of a Ukrainian student group following the sort of playbook of the Zionist organizations, which is to say that any challenging of their political views is a, you know, sort of a hate instance of hate. It was a similar method, similar tactic 6 weeks or 2 months ago now, I guess, when we had an event at Carleton. They tried to shut it down. And then there was a couple articles afterwards basically saying, going after the PIRG, the Public Interest Research Group, that had all they had really done is book the room for this event on paths to peace in Ukraine. And they booked the room for the Ottawa Peace Council, and they were saying that the PIRG should have its funding cut from students because they had just, you know, booked this room for the Peace Council, which they've been like doing for years and years.
You were attacked in that instance by a guy named Matthew Selinger, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, and he called you, he says Eve Engler is a, quote, master of historical revisionism that runs in line with Russian propaganda. And he also said that the OPIRG should be held to account for allowing the hateful and vilifying rhetoric of the meeting that you had scheduled and that went ahead in this instance. what was the title of that event again?
I believe it was the Path Towards Peace in Ukraine.
Hateful. That sounds just horrendous.
Very hateful stuff.
But it went ahead. All of these meetings did go ahead, though, right?
They did. They all did go ahead. They, you know, and to be honest with you, I mean, these weren't, in the case of the Carlton event, it was like planned 4 or 5 days beforehand. There was, I don't know, 25 people that showed at King's College. Maybe it was more like 50 people, but again, that event was about Palestine. I wouldn't even have touched on Ukraine except for the fact they put out this statement. And I actually did an event at McMaster in Hamilton the day before, and there was also doesn't seem as formal of an effort to shut it down, but the security got involved and stuff. But yeah, it's a pretty remarkable climate. I mean, you know, I posted a clip where I asked Justin Trudeau on Sunday here in Montreal at this Greek parade why he keeps ramping up the proxy war with Russia, and these establishment, this guy from the McDonnell Laurie Institute slams this as like this out there crazy just a FU Trudeau people. And same thing when there was a protest against Joe Biden's visit to Ottawa, I tweeted out about it. Same person from the McDonnell Laurie Institute, which is, you know, a supposedly respectable think tank. He framed a protest against the U.S. president as just a some sort of like wild out there kind of right wing, left wing coming together in this. I mean, you know, protesting U.S. war in Vietnam, protesting U.S. Invasion of Iraq, protesting U.S. Contra war against Nicaragua. I mean, there's a long history of protesting U.S. militarism by Canadians. And so to reframe this stuff is all kind of like, you know, not as, you know, anti-war and not as, you know, a real effort at understanding what's actually going on in Ukraine and not just this sort of Russia bad, NATO good kind of framing that we get in our media. It's considered, you know, really marginal. And so these Ukrainian student groups on campus, even though there's like, you know, 25, 40, 50 people showing up at these events, they're trying to shut them down, which personally it seems almost, you know, just ignore it rather than. But I think it's like they fear that if you get give a little space to people questioning the dominant narrative, then maybe that will start snowballing. And so what they want to do is, of course, just not even have that discussion. But I think it's very much reflective of the political climate where they feel comfortable to, you know, explicitly call for shutting down of events about the path towards peace.
Well, it sounds like full spectrum dominance of the political debate.
For sure. That's they feel like that, you know, they have that and they want to enforce that by making sure that, you know, a dozen or two dozen students don't hear a different perspective.
And did you say that was the McDonald Laurier Institute that talked about left and right coming together in criticizing you?
Yeah, it's Kolga. I think Marcus Kolga, I believe he heads up the disinfo program at McDonald Laurier Institute, established maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And that at that time it was more focused on Russia, you know, intervening in Canada for disinfo. Now, of course, it's sort of shifted towards China. That was, of course, or maybe not surprisingly, funded by the U.S. Embassy. That's who provided the seed funding to the McDonnell Laurier Institute to help Canada oppose, you know, foreign disinformation. You know, when it's the U.S. funding in it, of course, it's not foreign intervention. But when it's, you know, Russia or China, then it's foreign intervention and foreign disinformation. But yeah, so this is the climate. It's you know, imperative that we do what we can to break through this climate. I know at University of Victoria there's been a real campaign against the Young Communist League, which is on this issue from the Ukrainian groups. I think that one of the things that should be done in the fall is that with the new semester at university, there should be a national tour to as many campuses as possible to organize events to really kind of shove it right in their faces and say, no, we're gonna have these events on campus, and you know, you can come and you can criticize, but we're not gonna shut us down. But definitely have to kind of puncture the one-sided media sphere on this.
The last time you and I spoke was in early February, and on that same program, I featured Tyan Cherepushek and Tyson Strandland, both Canadians of Ukrainian descent that were caught in the maelstrom of the UVic debate back then. And I haven't followed up, actually. I'm not sure what became of it, but they were taking a lot of heat at the time, at least. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Eve Angler. Eve's an independent Montreal-based journalist and author. He's written a dozen books on Canadian foreign policy, including Canada and Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority. That's with Anthony Fenton. His recent article, Canadian Government Prioritizes War Over Climate Crisis, is a troubling portrait, I say, of a country few here in our home and native land would recognize. Well, another issue that I wanted to talk to you about, and you covered in that article too, is what's going on in Haiti. I said in the introduction, Eve, that the Ottawa must think that the gold egg laying goose that is the tax revenue craw collectors is an endless font of lucre, the way that they're throwing the money around. And just last week, they announced $100 million more to be doled out to Haiti's police and military. What's going on?
Well, the U.S., Joe Biden was in Ottawa partly to press Canada to lead a foreign military mission to Haiti. That's something that's been on the agenda for about, it's a good 8 months now, really, when Canada began the process of building international support for that. It was stymied, I think, in significant part because Russia and China have been unwilling to go along with the U.S. push at the Security Council for a United Nations mission. And the Caribbean countries and other Latin American countries aren't keen without a U.N. Force under U.N. umbrella. And so Canada has been right at the center of this process now for, you know, like I said, months and months. And so they've, you know, they've sent spy aircraft to spy over Haiti. They just sent two naval vessels off the coast. And so, but they don't want to send an actual military force. And so they made a big announcement of another $100 million to the Haitian police. You know, I've been very critical of Canada's role with the Haitian police now going back two decades, because basically after overthrowing the elected government in 2004, well, first of all, before overthrowing elected government in 2004, they worked to undermine the Haitian police. So there was a sort of fledgling police force that was actually being attacked by the rebel forces from the Dominican Republic that were paramilitaries, former Haitian soldiers that were working to destabilize the elected government. And so at that time, in the early 2000s, the U.S. and Canada were trying to weaken the Haitian police because it was, you know, to a certain extent, defending the elected government. And there was, I think, a genuine effort to try to have a somewhat functioning police force. And you know, we can debate police forces kind of at a general level and whether we want to, you know, defund the police. But in the case of Haiti, I mean, the history is these policing forces and military security forces have really just been like tools of political intervention, usually by the U.S. And that's certainly been the case since the U.S. occupation of 1915 to 34, where they created the modern Haitian military. And they used that to overthrow government. So anyways, in the early 2000s, there was a sort of fledgling force that was protected, you know, it was that defended the elected government from these paramilitary attacks, and Canada, U.S. worked to undermine it. And then after the coup, they integrated all these former military, all these people with terrible human rights records that had been, you know, basically tools of Washington and tools of the Haitian elite. They integrated into the Haitian police force, and that force killed, you know, hundreds, thousands even in the 2 years of the coup government from 2004 to 2006. And then it continued on, and it's sort of, you know, been the tool of in part of elite and foreign influence in the country. Now, so fast forward to today, the unfortunate situation is that the security situation in Haiti has disintegrated to such an extent that you can make a case that the police force is, you know, somewhat progressive, right? To put it differently, to build up the repressive apparatus of the Haitian state, i.e. the police, that in fact has somewhat of a progressive dimension to it, because the alternative is so grim. Now, obviously, there's all kinds of complications within that. There's all kinds of ties between the gangs that have all kinds of influence and the Haitian police. And there's, you know, it's still a very repressive apparatus. They still, you know, kill peaceful demonstrators. They still kill journalists reporting on them, et cetera, et cetera. But the situation, again, has disintegrated so much. So, but the Canadian government announced another $100 million in aid to the police. You know, I'm kind of somewhat agnostic on it. Don't support it. I wouldn't be, you know, harshly critical of it like I would be in the past, because, like I said, things have gone so sour. Obviously, if you broaden the political context to understand how Canada has overseen this disintegration of Haitian political life, of Haitian security, of just, you know, Haitian society, particularly in Port-au-Prince, Canada is obviously a huge culprit. And as the Solidarité Québec Haïti press release on this issue pointed out, that, you know, these are the ones that, you know, lit the fire in Haiti, and now they're justifying putting out the flames, and they're the ones that need to, you know, be called on to put out the flames. But it's a grim situation. I mean, the simple demand, and I think the one that should be front and center on Canada's role in Haiti, is why are we part of this core group of foreign ambassadors that appointed Ariel Henry, who is overseeing the last 20 months of disintegration, and this core group has had all this influence over Haiti for the most of the past two decades.
Well, and Henry is the unelected prime minister who, you know, doesn't know when to cave, essentially. But Eva, is any of this money? I mean, who's designing where this so-called aid to the militarized police in Haiti is going to go? And this isn't for beat cops. This is, Canada's already sent armored personnel carriers, weaponry. They've had the Canadian military doing exercises and flying over. He's saying that they're going after the gangs by air and by sea. I mean, this doesn't look like they're trying to make the neighborhood any safer for Haitians.
Well, I would say I'm of two minds on that. Like, I think things from a strictly Canadian capitalist perspective, things have disintegrated so much in Haiti that the Haitian elite and their allies among the Canadian, you know, capitalist class that have interests in Haiti, they want a reduction in the kidnapping, in the insecurity. Even the wealthy, even Piétonville, the wealthier neighborhood of Port-au-Prince, way up the hill, even their insecurity has reached a point where it's, you know, difficult to function. So I do think that the Canadian government and the U.S. government want a more stabilized, undemocratic regime, right? Obviously there's all these contradictions within that, in that it's the PHTK, this like oligarchic capitalists or oligarchic gangsters that we've like sort of imposed over the past 12 years in Haiti, the political party that's been ruling for the last 12 years. That's they've been working with these you know, criminal elements that have empowered the criminal elements to the point, and they did it in part for political reasons, right, to repress the population, because they know that the majority of population is not on board with their very regressive policies. But I think from a strictly business perspective, things have spiraled out of control from a Canadian corporate and a U.S. corporate kind of perspective. So I think that the Canadian government is actually of two minds, and that they do want to sort of, you know, a more functioning state apparatus that has, you know, greater control over Port-au-Prince specifically. But simultaneously, the thing they're most concerned about is they don't want those popular forces, the those who've been calling for poverty with dignity for the past 30 years in Haiti, that we've worked to sabotage repeatedly, mostly through the to the organizational structure of Famille Lavalas and Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the most popular politician in the country. What the thing Canada wants, you know, the least thing they want to work against the most is to make sure that they don't get power. So they prefer, you know, chaos than sort of a popular sovereignty-minded political movement from gaining power. But they don't. I don't think they actually do want the current situation either.
You mentioned Aristide when he was in, though. I recall that he disbanded the army in, 2004. Am I remembering that right?
He disbanded the army in 95, just as his mandate. He was, of course, elected in 1990, took office in 91. He had lasted 8 months, and then he was overthrown in a military coup that lasted for more than 3 years. And he was returned to office for about 18 months. And at the end of his mandate, this was part of the struggle when the Americans and Canadians were trying to get their people in the military. They were supposed to, you know, get the human rights abusers out of the military. And there was a sort of political battle going on between Aristide and primarily Washington. And then Aristide responded by saying, "Okay, I'm just eliminating the military, and I'm going to keep the ban, the military ban, to fulfill the basic constitutional requirement to have some military, which you just kept the military ban, and then to have a police force." And I think that this was something that was, you know, widely viewed as a big step forward for human rights in Haiti, because the military had really just been a tool of repression that, again, was created. The modern Haitian military was created during the U.S. occupation of 1915 to 1934. But it was former military that the U.S. and the Haitian elite used to come attack the elected government via the Dominican Republic between 2001 and 2004 to destabilize the Aristide government and ultimately take control of a few cities that provided the pretext for the U.S. and Canada to send the troops to physically remove Aristide from the country.
Well, and this in the context of decades of brutal dictatorship of the Duvalier father and son, and before that too.
For sure. And so, the Haitian population has had a longstanding bad relationship to state forces with guns. they have done a lot of horrors to keep the poor. And so in that context, any Canadian contribution, $100 million contribution to giving more guns to a state apparatus that is designed to work against in a very aggressive way the population is obviously something that should be questioned quite aggressively.
And I'd like to question that very much, but not. I'd like to question that in the context of the Canadian military. We're out of time for this segment, Eve. Can you stick around and can we extend?
For sure.
Now, I'm going to take a break, and I'll be back with Prasenna Shan Mugathas. We're going to talk about his fantastic film series, Truth to the Powerless, a series that, Eve, you took part in, I know. It's an investigation into Canada's foreign policy, which, of course, is your bailiwick as well. But stick around after the break for that. Thanks, Eve. Well, I gotta think that we're not alone.
I'm sitting in my house watching all this happen, and I've arrived to a point where I just can't keep my mouth shut anymore.
Guerrilla Radio, you're not alone. So now, Eve, I mentioned the $100 million that just recently, last week or 10 days ago, the Canadian government said, on top of all the other money that it sent down to Haiti. The budget, the Canadian budget, the federal budget, came in yesterday as we're recording this. And I know that you follow this very closely. How did the military do? I know that there's been a lot of criticism about the budget, that it didn't give anything for, you wrote yourself about the environment, but also about the healthcare system seems to be left in the lurch, transportation as well. But the military doesn't seem to be hurting. Have you followed how they made out?
Yeah, the military has had a good year. But it's had a particularly good last couple weeks or a week or so with Joe Biden's visit, and there's been all kinds of announcements and of increased military spending. And in the budget, Tamara Lawrence, a well-known peace activist, did a tweet that looked at some of the military parts in the budget. $38.6 billion over 20 years for NORAD, $2.1 billion over 7 years, and another $700 million for a NATO budget line, another $1.4 billion over 14 years for new critical weapon systems needed to protect Canadian Armed Forces in case of high-intensity conflict, including air defense, anti-tank, and anti-drone capabilities. A whole series of other big budget lines. Of course, you know, confirming more than 50. Tamara says more than $55 billion for NATO and NORAD programs, and that just announced. And then, of course, more money for Ukraine. And then during Biden's visit, or a day or two before Biden's visit, they announced $1.4 billion to enhance the Dwyer Hill base where the Joint Task Force 2, the Canadian Special Forces, are based. We got the big fighter jet. They announced $7.3 billion, I believe it was, to just upgrade current bases so they can handle the F-35s. So the F-35s are going to cost, I think it's, we don't really know exactly, but something around $20 billion up front, probably about $70 billion over the life cycle. But on top of that, they, you know, they need to upgrade some of the landing strips and different.
Well, from what I've seen, they don't really need landing strips. They're infamously crash prone, these incredibly expensive pieces of machinery. But let's not be all bad on them, though. It looks like they got one thing right. They're going to send along the release I'm looking at from the DND, $244.8 million to promote culture changes and modernize the military justice system. But more importantly, they want to expand health and physical fitness services to be more responsive to women's needs. So, I mean, they're moving in a progressive direction by the sounds of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's like the big debate you can have on the military is you're allowed to sort of criticize it for being a hub of sexual violence and misogyny. That's sort of like, there's a fairly rigorous debate that's been happening. It's kind of died down over the past year because the Ukraine NATO proxy war has kind of overshadowed it, and we've gone into this. You don't even want to criticize the, you know, sexual violence in the military, but there had been a couple years of quite extensive debate on that. But, you know, what Canadian weapons are used to kill people or kill women in Afghanistan or girls in Libya or that, that's not really, you know, a debate that's allowed to be had in any sort of rigorous way. Yeah, I mean, the military is in the Trudeau government is into talking about how there's problems with racism and sexism in the military, but they're certainly not into questioning the utility of the whole force. And just, you know, one point that always needs to be kept in mind when we talk about the Canadian military and funding the Canadian military, and Biden's visit, you know, proved it one more time, which is every dollar that's given to the Canadian military is one more dollar for the U.S. empire. There are very few countries, maybe if any others, where a neighboring country, the main demand or a main demand that the president of that country or leader of that country makes when coming to the other country, bordering country, is to increase your military spending. Most countries don't want the country on their border to increase their military spending because they're nervous they could invade, or if they may want to invade the other country, that increasing military spending might provide some defense from a, you know, a potential invasion. But in the case of Canada, the U.S. constantly pressures Canada to spend more and more on the military because the Canadian military is structured from its operational doctrine to the weapons it purchases to the thinking of the military leadership to work to expand the U.S. power around the world. And, you know, one of the announcements Anita Anand made a couple days ago here was she boasted about how we got three naval vessels that have just been dispatched to the South China Sea to, you know, go on those provocative missions that the U.S. leads to, you know, right around Chinese territorial waters. And